We've all experienced loneliness at some time in our life. For many of us, it's a passing phase, something from which we recover, like the emptiness we feel after a divorce or the death of a loved one. But for some, loneliness is a constant feeling, something that happens on the inside, not necessarily easy for others to detect. And that feeling, our guest says, could be lethal. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:07 on Tuesday, May 28th. Judith Shulevitz is the science editor and chief science writer for The New Republic. Her latest article, The Lethality of Loneliness, delves into our evolving definition of loneliness, its impact on our health, and the history of research on the subject. She joins us this hour to share with us what she learned in that article. Judith, good morning.
Good morning, Cynthia. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Thank you so much for being with us. This was a fascinating article. And I just want to establish, first of all, how should we define loneliness for the purposes of this discussion?
Well, so one of the debatable points, but a point that's pretty much accepted among psychologists, is that loneliness is not the same thing as being alone. Loneliness is not spending, you know, months on the desert meditating or on a long hike. It's not even not necessarily having very rich or dense social networks. Loneliness is a feeling. It's an experience. It's the experience of lacking intimate friends and family and partners with whom to share what needs to be shared.
Mm. And are we talking about loneliness as a temporary state of being, maybe like a, you know, I've got 2 hours of free time in the middle of the day and gee, I wish someone was here with me? Or are we talking about a long-term sort of a chronic state of mind?
Well, it's mainly a chronic state of mind. There are just people who are lonelier and have a harder time connecting to others, and those are the people who are more likely to be lonely. Although it does vary depending on where you are in your life. There are periods of life when you're probably going to be lonelier. That involves, you know, leaving home and going to college or moving to another city or retiring and exiting the workplace and losing the sort of sense of community you get from that.
Mm-hmm. And when we experience loneliness on a long-term basis even, what is physically happening inside our body?
Well, what happens if we feel loneliness for a long period of time is that what happens when we feel acute loneliness to begin with is that our body goes into, surprisingly, fight or flight mode. So that we react with an adrenaline rush, our tissues become inflamed, a whole cascade of biochemical events occur, and we get ready for something very stressful to happen, which is a good thing to do if, in fact, something stressful is about to happen. But if you live in that state for a long time, then it can have very deleterious effects on your health.
Like what?
Well, to live in a constant state of sort of adrenaline excitement means, as I said, through a long cascade of events, it causes your tissues to become inflamed. It can breed cardiovascular disease. It can lead to narrowing of arteries, which makes it harder for blood to pump through and which leads to higher blood pressure. It can lead, ultimately, sort of living in this state can lead to reduced cognitive functioning, reduced self-control, what they call executive functioning, obesity, diabetes. A lot of surprisingly serious health problems have been linked to feeling chronically lonely.
Well, and I was surprised to read that it's linked to Alzheimer's, which I in my mind, I just sort of think of that as a genetic disease, something you inherit.
There's very few diseases in the world that are just genetic diseases. Mm-hmm. Everything is a relationship between the gene and the environment. Mm-hmm. So you may be predisposed to Alzheimer's, but loneliness actually has a very strong correlation with accelerated cognitive decline. So you put that together with a vulnerability to Alzheimer's, and you're going to get a speeding up of the progress of Alzheimer's.
And why does it interfere with our ability to actually ward off disease?
Well, there are sort of two kinds of immunity that we enjoy in life. And one is immunity from these kinds of stressors or even physical blows that we might be subject to. So physical attacks. And that's the kind of immune system that gets activated when we feel lonely, which is very weird. And I will explain in a moment why that is. And that sort of, if we're going to be in that state, it's going to drain resources from a different kind of immune system that we have going, which prevents us from viruses and other bacteria from other invaders from affecting our system. If you put all your resources into fighting off essentially predators, then you're not going to have the resources to fight off viruses. That's the really simple way of putting it. Mm.
Well, let's take a step back. Your article describes a number of studies done on loneliness. And if you could just set us up a little bit with, when did the world of science start thinking about loneliness as a problem worth studying?
Well, even the world of psychoanalysis didn't start thinking about loneliness as a problem until about the 1950s. So a famous psychoanalyst named Frieda Fromm Reichmann, who later became really famous because she was the model for Dr. Greenberg in I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, a book or movie that many of your listeners may have either read or seen or heard about. And she, in the 1950s, decided to write about it. She realized that nobody was writing about it as a topic. It was mentioned in passing. But it really wasn't a topic of examination until the 1950s, and there were a couple different things happening. She was writing about it. There was a psychologist in Wisconsin, actually a very famous psychologist named Harry Harlow, mm-hmm. who was doing experiments with monkeys, rhesus macaque monkeys, isolating them, taking babies away from their mothers and raising them in isolated cages for long periods of time, and discovering that they were just psychologically extremely disturbed, but also physically in poor health as well. And he was actually not a mean guy. He was doing this because it was the standard protocol at the time for both children and lab animals to raise them in isolation if they weren't going to be with their mothers.
And you talk about how some of that that research is evolving today and sort of being used in scientific labs now. Can you talk about how?
Yes. So, in fact, the successor to this, Harry Harlow, is a guy named Steve Sumi, and he's in Maryland now. He's actually working with the descendants of Harlow's original monkeys, and he is doing similar experiments. They're not as cruel as Harlow's were, but because he's doing them today, he's able to look at them and study them in ways that Harlow couldn't. For example, he can take, tissue, he can even take brain tissue, and he can look at how the experience of isolation changes the way cells function, it changes the way genes express themselves, it changes the way brains function, and he can see that this external experience of being, isolated in extreme conditions can actually change the way your body works. And this is being put together with all kinds of studies that people are doing on humans, and we're beginning to see that this stuff goes all the way down.
Mm-hmm. And what did researchers learn about loneliness by studying gay men during the initial AIDS outbreak?
Okay, so that was a really interesting study. So obviously you had these places where there were large cohorts of gay men becoming infected and dying. And some psychologists became interested in what the social conditions were that led to people who were infected with HIV dying more quickly or more slowly. And they began to try to isolate different factors. Was it being poor? Was it being not having social support, having family that was very hostile to homosexuality? What was it exactly? So they tested all these different factors, and what it turned out to be was being in the closet. If you were a gay man who was in the closet, infected with HIV, you were likely to die from HIV infection, have it bloom into AIDS, and die from AIDS much more quickly. And the reason for that was that people who are in the closet are very cut off from others. They can't really be intimate except with a few, people in their inner circle. There's a lot of disconnectedness, alienation, and isolation that comes with being in the closet. And so the people studying this realized it wasn't just being in the closet. It was really a way of talking about loneliness and disconnectedness.
So did they identify that this group was likelier to be lonely, or did they just discover that along the way as they were trying to study other factors?
It's a kind of chicken and egg situation. Somebody who's going to go into the closet is probably much more vulnerable to rejection. and can't take it, and so they're going to wall themselves off from rejection by going in the closet. So they might be just more susceptible. But conversely, being in the closet means you're not going to have as many true, genuine friends. You're going to have a lot of friends whom you lie to, but you're not going to have as many true, genuine friends as somebody who isn't in the closet. So it's a sort of chicken and an egg thing. But one thing that's interesting that comes into this whole AIDS study is the role of rejection in loneliness. So one of the things about men in the closet is they're afraid of rejection. And rejection, of course, is a part of loneliness, fear of rejection and being rejected. And we have also discovered that social rejection is processed by the body in the same way that physical pain is. Mm-hmm. Not entirely, but in many similar ways. And it sets off, again, the same chain of events that physical pain can. And, you know, living in a state of physical pain can degrade a lot of bodily functions, and so it turns out can living in a state of social pain.
That's interesting, and I want us to dig into that a little bit later. First, I wanted to ask you, though, you point out that loneliness is an interior subjective experience. In other words, it's something that we're feeling on the inside. It's not something that others can necessarily see on the outside. Does that make it harder to diagnose and treat?
Yes, and people aren't always good reporters on their own loneliness. There's a fellow I quote a great deal in the study, John Cacioppo, and he's sort of the leading psychologist of loneliness in this country, and he has done studies on people who say, no, not lonely, don't have any friends, but not lonely, I'm perfectly happy. But when he looks into their sleep patterns, he looks into their heart health, he looks into a variety of things in their bodily and daily functioning, he discovers that they have the exact same physiological profile of a lonely person. So even though they claim not to be lonely, even though in a state of lacking intimacy with anyone, they actually are lonely. So people don't always know when they're lonely.
And even if we're in contact with people frequently, we can still be lonely.
Well, yeah, it's really about the quality of the relationship and not about the quantity. If you have no relationship in your life where you feel truly, genuinely understood, seen, and responded to, and you can truly feel yourself, you might well be lonely even if you're married and have kids and are part of a community. It's probably less likely, actually, mm-hmm. but it still could happen.
So I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not an expert in this field, but what would be my first clue if someone that I know is lonely, if I can't easily detect that just by talking to them?
Well, I think we all see people in our world who just don't seem to be able to make connections with others very easily, mm-hmm. And who seem a little bit sort of cut off. And so the person you see may not admit to being lonely, because after all, that's a stigma. To be a lonely person, that's mm-hmm. shameful. We don't want to admit to that. So people may not admit to loneliness. They may not want to talk about their loneliness. But I think you can see it in how well they are able to relax and be themselves and whether they have close and warm friendships.
Our guest is Judith Shulevitz. She's a science editor for The New Republic, and her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We now know how it can ravage our body and our brain. She's with us this hour to talk about what she found along the way as she researched this article and to take your calls as well. We're wondering, have you gone through a lonely stretch in your life? Were you able to get out of it, and how so? Do you know someone who's lonely and you're not sure quite how to reach out? Maybe we have some suggestions for you. You can call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about loneliness and what its impact on our health may be. We're talking with Julia Shulevitz. She's science editor and chief science writer for The New Republic, and her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We now know how it can ravage our body and brain. Judith, I'm wondering, how did you get interested in writing about loneliness?
Well, in fact, I have to apologize because I sort of thought you were asking that question before, but then I realized you were asking the listeners. And I sort of laughed because I was a very lonely person, and I only realized after I started writing this that was why I started writing. And I was a very lonely child, and one of those kids who didn't connect well with others and didn't have a good relationship with my parents particularly. And it was, you know, it was actually a lot of really hard work. I worked with a therapist, and I made a very conscious decision at a certain point in my life to become part of a community. When I was a young professional, the only people I knew were other people in my profession, mm-hmm. and that was not a very warm community. And I joined a synagogue, and I became very active in it because I just thought this is real community, and this kind of job-related, you know, network that I'm part of is not real community. So therapy and joining and becoming active in a community are the two things that saved me. But I became interested in this for personal reasons, so I only realized that about halfway through my research.
Yeah. Well, how did you, as you were exploring these different avenues, the synagogue or at least to spending time with your colleagues or people in your line of work, how did you know that you found the right place, that this was your solution to the problem of loneliness?
When you find a friend you really like, when you find a group of people whom you want to hang out with, when you are, you know, when you feel held, you know, socially speaking, when you feel contained and held and mm-hmm. loved, I guess would be the way that I would put it. There are interventions that psychologists are working on. One of the most interesting involves actual training, like just a class with a smart board and a pointer, for people in the army. Mm-hmm. And what they're teaching are the skills required to actually recognize what people are saying when they say it. And one thing that they've discovered, and lonely people who are listening to this all know this, when you're lonely, you tend to interpret social cues in a negative fashion much more frequently than if you're sort of in a socially good place. And one of the things they're trying to train people to do is not react with this kind of fear and paranoia, but listen to people and what they're saying and react openly and warmly. And have a little more trust. I think that's the hard thing to learn. So they call this social cognition skills, and that's what they're teaching are social cognition skills. And it turns out that it's actually really working. It's helping soldiers get along better with other soldiers and with their platoon leader, and that's actually very important to the Army because they need that social solidarity to have a good fighting force.
So how are they actually teaching that? Because I imagine to have a negative response or to at least make negative assumptions about the way the world perceives us is a pretty innate habit and hard to break. So how do you teach that, especially in a classroom setting?
It's very hard, and they're still trying to figure out what actually makes a difference sitting in the classroom together or learning these actual skills. You teach it just by making people very aware of how they're reacting and by sort of positively reinforcing over and over and over again the positive social behavior. I suspect that, you know, a four-hour training session once a year is not going to do the trick. I think that people... You know, but I do think that this is the sort of thing that could be taught. It could be taught in school. It could be worked on with a therapist. There could be help groups. We're really at the beginning of thinking about loneliness as a social problem and trying to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, does loneliness beget loneliness, if that makes sense? I'm wondering if lonely people are making or behaving in a certain way because they make negative assumptions. Is that reinforcing the habit?
Wow. I mean, you're sort of saying maybe it's infectious. So if you are a lonely person and you're acting in a paranoid way, you make the people around you act in a paranoid way, and it's just sort of this loneliness spreads.
Or they think, she's such a negative person. I don't want to be around her,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you are. I mean, you definitely reinforce your own loneliness with your behavior. If you are a person who doesn't know how to bond, you're not going to bond, right? And part of the reason is that you're negative, you're down, you're a downer, you know, you're sort of socially awkward and people don't want to be around you. And it's definitely self-reinforcing. That kind of loneliness, characterological loneliness, probably developed in childhood and probably as a result of early childhood experiences. And that's why one of the people I talked to in the article, who's an economist actually, trying to quantify what loneliness is costing us as a society, believes that the best thing we could possibly do for in terms of loneliness and all the health and psychological consequences that flow from that would be to provide intensive early childhood intervention, especially for chaotic or underprivileged households where parenting is a sort of scarce resource.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, Judith Shulevitz is our guest right now. She's the science editor for The New Republic, and her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We have Dee in Amory waiting to talk to us. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I really agree with her, the idea of the difference between lonely and loneliness, because I experienced extreme loneliness in a huge amount of people. And it was because they were people that, even though they were relatives and, you know, comparatively would be family, I felt no connection to them whatsoever. In fact, I was almost wishing they weren't related to me. I mean, that was the situation I was in. But when I'm lonely, I know that I have the option of seeking out people so that I'm not lonely. And I think that's the difference between lonely and loneliness. I think loneliness is something that is inside, and it's pretty hard to combat. But if you're lonely, you have the option to, you know, seeking friends or acquaintances or whatever. And I think loneliness is much more detrimental to the individual.
Thanks, Dee, for those thoughts. Judith, do you have a response?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Dee means is the difference between being alone and lonely. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with her that when you know, people, there are a lot of people who do want to be alone. And one of the things that comes up around this topic a lot, or this discussion of whether we're losing a sense of community in America, and that's why people are lonely. And there definitely is a thinning out of this sort of, you know, neighborhood-based community that we used to have. But one of the things that Dee was talking about is that sense of loneliness you have inside the community. We forget that these very tight-knit communities can sometimes, you know, be oppressive as well, and there's something liberating about being alone so that you can choose your own friends.
Mm-hmm. Is there any link between shyness and loneliness? Are lonely people also less likely to put themselves out there?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there is. Of course there is. You know, if you don't have the ability to make the friends, then you are going to lack intimacy in your life. But there are shy people. Let me put it this way. There are quiet people who aren't socially forward people, or introspective people who aren't super gregarious people, who aren't lonely because they have high quality, fewer, but still high quality relationships that keep them going. Again, it's not the number of relationships. It's the quality of the relationships. But I would say probably there's a correlation between people who have a hard time going out there in the world and making friends and loneliness.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that one school of thought says that loneliness is a failure of social networks. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So the big debate in the field is it really just this internal perception, or is it let me back up for a moment. The big debate about the link between loneliness and health is whether it's this internal perception causing a series of physiological events that make you sick, mm-hmm. or whether it's the fact that you don't have people coming around and saying, or just friends who are around saying, gee, you kind of need to go to the doctor. You know, remember to go to your checkup. Gosh, you're eating kind of, you know, unhealthy foods. Let's get you eating healthier foods. When you're cut off from others, you're probably more likely to slip into bad habits, medical habits and nutritional habits that can also curtail your lifespan. So that's the big debate. Now, the economist whom I talked to, I asked him, I said, what do you think about the, you know, loneliness is an internal experience versus loneliness is a failure of social networks debate? And he said, really, can you really tease those apart? How do you tease those apart exactly? He says, to me, they're kind of the same thing. The one spawns the other. And I thought, okay, that makes sense too.
Hmm. Well, we've got Jim in Tomahawk waiting to talk to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's your question?
I had a little problem before with volume, but I'm on speakerphone now. I can hear it very well. I mentioned that when I was in my 20s, I had about an eight-month-long, it was a hetero relationship that suddenly broke, and I went into a depression. I had a job as two jobs, one as a counselor with some young people I really enjoyed. I was driving cab. I enjoyed meeting people in the cab, and yet I became depressed, and I would say I felt lonely. 40 years later, I had a two-year relationship end, and I was very anxious. A lot of anxiety came from it. No depression whatsoever. It was encouraging to me. But in between, there were 35 years of meditation. And I'm not saying that meditation is the right route for everybody, but it was a tremendous realization that I had matured.
Great. Well, thank you so much for telling us about it, Jim. Judith, is there a link between depression and loneliness?
Sure, of course. That's not to say that depressed people are necessarily lonely people and lonely people are necessarily depressed people, but sure, of course, the conditions are going to be linked. And being the kind of person who is likely to be lonely means, you know, you're probably also predisposed to depression, but also just this experience of loneliness is a depressing one. And so they are linked. But it's not clear that depression causes loneliness, for example. It's probably clearer that loneliness causes depression. And I would just add that meditation, it's becoming increasingly clear in the world of therapy that meditation is very helpful in overcoming sort of social problems and emotional problems, because it's about cultivating an attitude of mindfulness and this kind of cognitive self-awareness that they're trying to teach, for example, in that program in the Army. What is meditation but looking at yourself in a calm way?
Mm-hmm. And taking things one step at a time, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got Tom in Eau Claire next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering if your research found any links between being an only child and, I'll call it, unhealthy loneliness.
Well, I'm sure there is research on that, because it's unbelievable how much research there is on everything. I haven't looked into that. There is actually a book coming out pretty soon on being an only child, and if you want to go on my website and send me your email address, I cannot remember either the name or the author right now, but I can send you a link. I can figure it out and send you a link to that book, which is coming out in a few weeks, actually. I would say that, you know, being an only child could either mean that you were showered with incredible love and attention, such as, you know, children from families with many siblings probably crave, or it could mean that you didn't learn how to get along with your peers as well, and so then you feel that you're at a disadvantage socially. But I don't think that you could say that it makes you lonely.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is Judith Shulevitz. She's the science editor for The New Republic, and her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We're talking about what loneliness does inside our body, how it impacts our health, and how to manage that. You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Judith, we touched on just a little bit the neurological response to rejection, but I wanted to dig into that more deeply. I think that's a fascinating area that you explored in your article. So what happens in the brain when we are excluded from a social group?
Well, so this work, the work I talked about in my piece, is a famous experiment called the Cyberball experiment, and it's a very elegant experiment in which a person, is brought into a room and told to play a computer game with another person, in fact, two other people, that involves tossing a ball on the computer back and forth among the three of them. And actually, these two other people are a computer program, and at a certain point, they're programmed to start tossing the ball only to each other and to leave out the person in the room. and the person in the room is, you know, has one of those funny caps on their head and is being looked at. And what has been discovered is that a certain part of the brain that also processes physical pain consistently lights up when a person feels rejected. And it's kind of hard not to feel rejected in that situation. As slight as the rejection may be, you just suddenly do feel rejected. And follow-up studies have confirmed that this is sort of where one of the places we process social rejection. And I asked the psychologist who conducted this experiment, well, how come then I can tell the difference between being dumped by my boyfriend and being slapped in the face? You would think that if what you're describing is true, I shouldn't be able to tell the difference. This should be the exact same kind of pain. And she said, well, there are other things going on with physical pain. We're processing sensory input, et cetera, et cetera. But there's some way in which the two things are similar. That has huge consequences. One of just to take one that she and I talked about, she says, you know, on a playground, we would never let a child hit another child, or, you know, if that happens, we'd punish the hitting child, and that behavior is in, you know, most schools everywhere not tolerated. But social exclusion, you know, is rarely interfered with, and yet it can be just as painful and just as sort of neurologically damaging. I thought, wow, I never thought of that before.
To think of that from the teacher's perspective, using this scenario of a recess outside or something, and we see a kid hitting another kid, that's an easy solution. Remove the two children, tell the other one not to hit the other kid.
Right.
But how do you tell someone, you have to spend time with this person? Don't reject Johnny
I
over
mean,
there.
I am not a teacher, and I think that's really, really hard. But I think that there are ways in which you can teach children as a group about exclusion, about the need to include others, mm-hmm. about clique forming, about kindness, about standing up for people who are being bullied. I mean, we're obsessed in this country with bullying, and that's just a very extreme form of social rejection. And I do think somebody who is in this field would speak about this more clearly than I can. But I think that there are definitely many, many programs out there that attempt to teach children how not to hurt, socially exclude, and hurt other children who are different or vulnerable or whatever it may be. How effective they are, that you'd have to talk to somebody in the field.
Right. Sorry to put you on the spot there. Just a bit of curiosity on my mind. That's Judith Shulevitz. She's the science editor for The New Republic and chief science writer for The New Republic. Her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We now know how it can ravage our body and our brain. And she's taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about loneliness this hour and its impact on our health. Our guest this hour shares some of the latest research going on about loneliness and our health. Our guest is Judith Shulevitz, science editor and chief science writer for The New Republic. Her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. Judith, we have some more calls waiting for us. Let's go to Jamie in Marshfield. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning. Thank you. This is a very eye-opening show today. I really appreciate it. And it made me think about a parent that I have that lives out of town who really seems to claim that they are happy to be alone, will choose not to attend different family functions. But how do I know if they're really just really like to be alone or they're really just lonely and I just need to find different ways to reach out? And do you have any suggestions on how to reach out?
Did you say this was a parent? I sort of missed that word.
Yes, it is a parent.
A parent, okay. And do they live in a community with others? Do they have a set of friends?
Or somewhat, not as many as I guess I'd like to see, which is what worries me a little. This person spends a lot of time alone.
Well, I think it's very hard to say, but you know, if you think it's affecting their health, this isn't an intrusion, you might be able to talk to their doctor, although they might not want you to, unless you know it's gotten to an advanced state. You know, that does it could be the classic sign of depression and loneliness plus depression of not wanting to sort of come interact with others, or it could just be somebody who really does like to be alone. I don't know your parent well enough to know if there are people who just really like get a lot of pleasure out of their own company, and that's why they make this distinction between being alone and being lonely. If you think it's affecting their medical care, for example, they're not seeing the doctor as much as they should. If you think it's affecting their diet, they're not eating healthily because they're not in a community of healthy eaters. And you know, also loneliness sort of depresses executive function, as I've said, and so people get into bad eating habits and eat too much. If you think all that is going on, then you maybe, you know, you could go and talk to them and say maybe we could find you somebody to talk to, like a counselor or something like that. But it's tough to know, you know, just from what you've said, whether they're just those kind of rugged, individualistic type people, much celebrated in American lore, or they're people who need, you know, more friends.
Thank you. You've given me some good things to kind of keep my eye open for. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thanks, Jamie. We're going to go next to Eloise in Montello. Hi.
Hello.
There.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I go to church regularly, and every once in a while the minister up there speaks about hell and damnation for these people that are homosexual or gay or a lesbian or something, and it's been a topic over and over and over again. Do you think that may impact on the people who are gay or lesbians, in that making them feel negatively or apart because they're going to go to hell, that the church says that?
Yes. I'm sorry to laugh. Yes, I think it does. I'm laughing only because you put it very starkly. In fact, I talk about this in my article. Being a member of a marginalized or in any way stigmatized group actually means you are statistically more likely to be lonely. People who feel cut off in some way from the mainstream of their own society tend to be lonely. Interestingly, in societies with great social inequality, the poor tend to be lonelier than people of equal income levels in countries where there isn't social inequality. So if everybody's poor in a country, people are less lonely than if, you know, we live in a society that's increasingly unequal. And the poor who see the wealthier enjoying the benefits of wealth will feel cut off and lonely and stigmatized. So in any way, being marginalized in any way sort of ups your chances of feeling lonely. And I think that one of the things that's happened with gays and lesbians in our society, and happily it's being overcome somewhat, is that they have been seen as something shameful. And that, you know, that really makes a person want to withdraw. And then, of course, they're more likely to be lonely.
So it may not be surprising to consider some of these factors, that the elderly probably feel more lonely or the ostracized among us, because those are environmental factors. But one thing that struck me was that there's a hereditary component to loneliness.
Yes. So it does seem that there are certain personality types that are predisposed to feel lonely, and that is somewhat affected by genes, that it is heritable to some degree. It's not really clear. I say in my article 48%, but you know, that's based on certain twin studies, and you know, it's a very fungible, fudgy number. But it does, and again, I want to stress that simply because there are genetic predispositions to a certain personality trait, that doesn't mean that you're going to have that personality trait. How you are raised and the society you are raised in and how people around you treat you and, you know, sort of what happens to you is all important as well. There's just an interaction between the gene and the environment.
Mm-hmm. And if external factors can change our genes, is there something we can change in our environment that would change our genes back? If that makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. It's actually not, our genes sort of stay the same, but what happens is they get turned on or off to greater or lesser degrees. And that is something that is very powerfully affected by the environment, whether our genes are expressed or suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you create an environment in which people are sort of, say, a gene that manufactures certain stress-related hormones is overactive because you put the person under a lot of stress, if you take them out of that environment, that gene is likely to stop manufacturing those hormones and stop being overactive. So, yes, you can. What you can break, you can heal through social forces.
Great. Well, we have a couple more minutes left for calls. If you want to join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Judith Shulevitz, science editor for The New Republic and author of the article, The Lethality of Loneliness. Coming up next, we've got Don from Janesville on the phone. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you doing today? Great program.
Thanks. What's your question for us?
The question is, how does, you know, I'm going to go back to PTSD. I'm a former combat Marine. And how does that affect it? Because I remember before going in, I was, you know, you go into a crowd of people and you feel great. Now when I go into a crowd of people, you know, there's the anxiety there from the PTSD. And the other comment or question I had was, when I came off active duty, when I retired, I sailed around the world. I was on a boat by myself for a year. And can you highlight the difference between being lonely and being alone? Because I feel more at ease and comfortable alone than I do in a crowd full of people when I'm experiencing what you're describing as the unhealthy loneliness.
Well, it's interesting. The experiment that I was talking about with social cognition training or teaching social cognitive skills is apparently reducing the incidence of PTSD among soldiers. It's thought to be leading toward that, and of course, something that sometimes tragically comes from that, which is suicide. It seems that being better able to relate to others, being able to trust others, being able to sort of not retreat into an atmosphere, into a sort of welter of anxiety and distrust and paranoia, does reduce the chance that somebody will get PTSD. So it seems that being able to stay connected and get help from others, accept help from others, and feel solidarity with those around you is going to sort of reduce that, the kind of anxiety and trauma that comes from PTSD. I'm not a psychologist, and I can't speak to exactly what the link is between loneliness training or cognitive awareness training and PTSD. But I would say that the difference between being alone and lonely is really just if you are happy in your own company. For example, artists and writers and people who do that kind of creative work often have to spend, you know, long periods of time by themselves. They're not in a group setting. And, you know, are they lonely people? Well, not if they're being happily productive and feeling good about being alone. No. If that trip around the world was satisfying to you and sort of restorative to you and you enjoyed your own company, you weren't lonely. If during that trip around the world you thought about how much you wished you were with somebody who you could talk to and share your experiences with and you missed that part of life keenly, then you were lonely.
Judith, I'm wondering, this may be hard to measure, but do you think there's more loneliness now than in the past, or has loneliness always been with us?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
There are a lot of debates about that. There are those who say there is more loneliness now. That seems to be a sort of consensus, but the numbers aren't very steep, and it probably doesn't have to do with social media, which is one theory that's very common out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say there has clearly always been loneliness with us. We definitely live in a society here in America in which we tend to be more cut off from extended family. We do move a lot, and every time you move, you're uprooted from your peer group and your group of friends and often family, and you have to make a whole new set of friends, and you may or may not succeed at that. you know, we do prize individualism and we do tend to downplay the importance of community building activities. So I think that we live in a society that probably pushes us towards loneliness more than a society that works against loneliness.
Mm-hmm. Is there research going on in this area, do you know?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of research, and it's all completely contradictory.
Of course. Well, I'm wondering, what's the most surprising discovery that you made when you were researching your article?
Well, to me, the fact that because I consider myself fairly naive about a lot of neurobiological things, I was stunned to discover that it is the subjective internal experience of feeling lonely that is thought to make you sick, rather than, you know, the social network aspect of it. So I would have thought it was because you didn't have friends bringing over dinner, or you didn't have anywhere to go, or whatever it was. I would have thought that was what would make you sick. But it turns out there's actually things going on that sort of link the brain to the body, and feelings to chemicals, biochemical reactions, that are making you sick. That floored me.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, along the way, as you researched that and you came upon that discovery, did you hear suggestions from people about the best ways to go about building community and define intimacy for those who are lonely?
No, I didn't read that much about that, but before I started writing about science, I wrote a book about religion, actually, and it was a book about the Sabbath, and it was a book about ways to use time to enhance community building. It wasn't just about the Sabbath, just taking that as an example. And I do think that involving yourself in these community-based activities that tend to be non-competitive, that tend to not be about profit or loss, but simply about coming together to try to make the world you live in better. I think that is just an amazing way to personally reduce your own loneliness. It could be a church, it could be a synagogue, it could be a volunteer group, it could be a soup kitchen, it could be, you know, the school board. But whatever it is, there are spaces in American life where you can come together and not feel judged and not be competing, but working together for a common good. And personally, just, you know, not speaking for the psychologists, personally, I would say that's the best way to alleviate loneliness I can think of.
Mm-hmm. When you took that initial step to join a synagogue and to try to find community that way, was it hard for you?
Very hard. I had a lot of very mixed feelings about religion. So that's what my book was about, was actually about my ambivalence about this whole religion thing. So I found that very hard. But I found, what I discovered is that, you know, religion is in many ways a sort of technology for making community and making community work for those who are in it. People who are in a church tend to score lower on loneliness tests. People who believe in God tend to score lonelier on loneliness tests, and people who have pets tend to score lonelier on loneliness tests. I mean, these, I personally think that the part where you're in a community has got to be the most important part of all of that.
Mm. Are there lessons that you learned from your research that change how you think about loneliness and maybe change your behavior?
Another thing that surprised me, I will also say, is that it turns out the people who study loneliness as a sort of physiological reaction think of it as a warning system, and an important warning system. And they say that it has an evolutionary function, and that we humans are social animals. We are acutely social animals. We are nearly as social as bees and ants. We are much more social than most mammals. And we are designed to be together. We are designed to protect each other because we're very, as physical animals, we're pretty weak, we're pretty slow. And we really can only protect each other in groups. And, you know, everything that we have built that's of consequence, we have built as a group. So we are designed to be together, and when we are cut off, when we are alone too much, we are supposed to feel uncomfortable, and it is supposed to send us scurrying back to the group. So I have learned that you're supposed to take these feelings as a warning signal and say, this is bad. I should do something about this. I need to go to a therapist, or I need to, you know, sort of make right with my family, or I need to join a volunteer group, or, you know, get into a better work environment. These feelings are actually designed to make us do something about them.
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting topic to think about, and I thank you so much for shedding some light on it.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. I really enjoyed it.
Sure. Thank you. Our guest was Judith Shulevitz, the science editor and chief science writer for The New Republic. And her latest article is The Lethality of Loneliness. We now know how it can ravage our body and our brain. We'll link to that story on our Facebook page if we haven't already. You can find it on The New Republic's website as well. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing and on-air producing this hour, and Rob Ferret for on-air direction. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Larry Mueller Show is coming up next.